Welcome to Tuesday. It's KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening. After a painful upheaval, Seattle has another new mayor for a couple of months. As you know, Ed Murray left office accused of sexual abuse. Yesterday, Councilmember Tim Burgess became mayor until a new one is elected. Either Carrie Moon or Jenny Durkin will take over, not in January, as usual, but in late November. Seattle Mayor Tim Burgess, welcome back to KUOW.
Thank you, Bill. Happy to be with you.
What's it like to suddenly take the helm of a major American city for 9 weeks?
It's like hooking up to a fire hose and they turn the water on, and it's quite a quite a rush here in terms of just the volume of things that have to be done. I mean, it's really clear that this is an important position, and I'm just grateful that I've had 10 years on the city council to be able to step in.
A fire hose. What is rush number one?
So right after my colleagues voted to appoint me as mayor yesterday, and before I was actually sworn in, I received an emergency preparedness briefing on, you know, how the city is prepared to react to a wide variety of emergencies. And then just meeting...
Wait a minute. Was there something unsettling about that we should know about?
No, it was not unsettling.
Okay.
In fact, just the opposite. It was quite reassuring.
Mm-hmm.
I was handed a portfolio that identifies a wide range of potential emergencies in the city, and there's a specific plan for each one. So that was very reassuring.
Mm-hmm.
And then this morning, just meeting with various members of the mayor's staff and working on the budget. I have to give a budget speech next Monday to the city council.
Yeah. We'll be tuned in.
Lots of things to do.
So, Mayor Burgess, when someone's elected, we talk about their mandate. Could you have a mandate?
I have a mandate from my colleagues on the city council to bring stability to the mayor's office, to make sure that the city government continues to function well and that city services are delivered. So I am clearly in a caretaker role here, and that's not a bad thing. So we'll respond to whatever comes before us in the coming weeks.
Well, you mentioned the budget. You mentioned stability. Do you have a two-month agenda?
I'm focused right now on the budget because we've got to deliver that to the city council next Monday. We're making a few adjustments, but nothing that significant. And then we'll present that on Monday.
Okay. Right before you, the council president was mayor. Bruce Harrell had 5 days in office. In that time, he issued 4 executive orders regarding youth detention, trash pickup, hacking vulnerability, and Amazon headquarters. How did you feel about those executive orders?
They're fine. We've looked at those, and those remain in effect as we go forward.
Will you execute all of them?
Yes. The question is how we execute the one related to Amazon. And while I think Seattle will be in an incredibly strong position to present to Amazon, I believe we'd be in a stronger position if our response to them is more regionally focused. And so we are beginning some conversations with some of our regional partners as to how best the region can respond to Amazon rather than just the city of Seattle by itself.
And do you think there's any decision you'll make in the next 9 weeks along those lines before you leave city government?
Yes, because Amazon has set a deadline in the middle of November for whoever wants to respond to their invitation to do so by mid-October, excuse me. So we have to get moving on this.
Are you weighing tax breaks, subsidies, anything like that we should know about?
No, nothing that we're ready to talk about yet. But we will have a strong regional response to their invitation.
Will you issue any of your own executive orders for Durkin or Moon to follow?
Not likely, but again, I've been here 1 day.
Yeah.
So let's see what happens.
Okay. A few things. What's happening with Key Arena versus a new Soto Arena?
So the mayor's, the previous mayor's proposal for Key Arena is now before the city council, and the special committee of the council that is considering that held a meeting yesterday morning. I actually participated in that hearing as a council member. But the ball's in their court now. And our executive side of city government will continue to respond to their questions and any concerns that they have. But this is now a decision for the city council to make.
Will you make Seattle police wear body cameras without having a new contract?
Yes. That executive order has been issued. There is a labor dispute that has been initiated by the union, but our police officers have started to wear the cameras, and that phase-in of our officers wearing them will continue.
The Seattle Municipal League recently issued a report saying Seattle could be heading for a financial crisis because of voter fatigue on levies, reductions in federal funding, a possible recession could crater city revenue. Do you agree that the city could be heading for some kind of fiscal crisis?
I'm not sure I would use those specific words, but I do agree that city government needs to tighten its belt a bit and be extremely prudent in how we use city resources. And the budget coming next Monday to the council will reflect that. I also am going to definitely continue the focus that frankly began under Mayor Nichols and was continued by Mayor McGinn and then Mayor Murray to introduce more accountability on how public funds are spent, more contracting for outcomes, more performance standards being met. That will definitely continue and be expanded in the budget proposal that's going to the council next week.
Do you, Mayor Tim Burgess, do you think you are more keenly attuned to belt tightening, more accountability, focus on outcomes than your now city council is? You're often considered the quote-unquote conservative on the in city government.
Ever since I joined the city council in 2008, I have preached more accountability and to make certain that we're using the taxpayers' money wisely and efficiently. I don't think that's a conservative or a liberal issue. I think that's good governance. And I think the people of Seattle who pay taxes deserve to know how their dollars are being spent and that those dollars are actually accomplishing what they're intended to accomplish. And so, you know, when I was on the city council, we introduced various pieces of legislation that upped the focus on accountability. We changed the Families and Education Levy to require specific measurable outcomes to be built into all of those expenditures. The Seattle Preschool Program has performance standards and pay for performance when the providers achieve the goals that we set mutually with them. They're not imposed on them. We set them between the city and the providers and mutually agree on what those should be. I think that's just good government. I think that's wise fiscal policy, and I will continue that.
Speaking of liberal conservative, the specter of Amazon growing elsewhere brings up the question of whether Seattle has an anti-business bias. What do you think?
I don't think we do, and I think the evidence of that is our business community is thriving. But at the same time I say that, many in our business community, especially among small business owners, do hold that view. And I made some comments yesterday about how important the business community is to Seattle's economic stability and our economic growth. They are vital partners. They're the ones who create jobs in our community, and we like that, and we want more jobs created. So I don't buy into the belief that city government has consciously tried to create an anti-business environment. In fact, Forbes magazine says that Washington State as a whole is the second best state in the country to start a business and to grow a business. So I don't think government policy that we've adopted have communicated any anti-business beliefs, but that opinion is held by some in the business community, and I want to listen to that and attempt to address that.
A couple of more questions for Seattle's mayor until late November, Tim Burgess. Have you seen the video of a man wearing a swastika armband getting knocked out by a punch on 3rd and Pine?
I've not seen the video, but I've heard about that incident.
We're going to talk about it in just a moment with an Antifa, anti-fascist group member. What do you want to say to the city about that?
There is no violence that is justified. None. It doesn't matter who does it. Violence is just not something that we accept in our city, and that's an unfortunate incident that occurred.
Maybe the final question. Two questions. Any advice for the next mayor about getting things done with the city council that you were on?
No, I don't have advice right now. Let's see who's elected mayor.
Yeah. Are you endorsing anyone? You did endorse someone, yes?
I have endorsed Jenny Durkin.
Okay. Final question. The way you got to be Seattle's mayor, Tim Burgess, was painful, and it's short-lived for you. Is there anything exciting about becoming the mayor of Seattle, Washington?
This is a great city, and I am just honored and humbled to have been on the city council and now to serve in this role as mayor of our city. It's a privilege. I take it very seriously. I think public service is a high calling. It is a worthy endeavor, and I'm delighted to be able to serve the people of Seattle this way.
Will you talk with us about your budget in a few days?
Sure, be happy to.
Tim Burgess, mayor of Seattle until the end of November. Thanks for this time.
You're welcome, Bill. Thank you.
And thank you for tuning in to KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. I mentioned the punch, the Nazi punch that a lot of people are talking about. That's coming up, as well as your images, the images you probably hold of Vietnam itself, the Vietnam War, the refugee experience. Maybe those images you have are holding us back, and maybe we can do better. That's coming up as well. Stay tuned. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Punch a Nazi just happened in downtown Seattle, caught on video. You see a confrontation at 3rd and Pine. Have you seen this video? A man wearing a swastika armband is talking heatedly when another man steps up and knocks him out with one punch. The puncher and the spectators appear to leave this man lying on the sidewalk, seeming unconscious. And this is something we have been talking about for months. Is it ethical? Is it even strategically wise, beyond ethics, to physically assault a white supremacist, a neo-Nazi? You'll remember there was violence on the University of Washington campus several months ago when the right-winger Milo Yiannopoulos spoke. My next guest suffered a gunshot in that event, the violence, the confrontation in Red Square. Josh Dukes, welcome to KUOW.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me.
For those who don't know, will you remind us what happened to you in Red Square that night?
I went to Red Square to kind of oppose Milo and also to kind of take a look around. We were kind of like looking for signs of Nazis at that event. Several other anti-fascists and myself had expected there to be violence.
You identify as an anti-fascist.
Yeah. I do. And so
Antifa, the group we've heard most about?
Yeah. the pronunciation is kind of like interesting. Everybody kind of plays around with it a little bit. It's German, so it's supposed to be pronounced loudly.
Loudly. Okay.
And that's about it. Yeah.
Okay. Antifa.
Yeah.
But you identify. This is, you know, we're familiar with that group from Charlottesville and Berkeley and so you're at this group to oppose the people who support Milo Yiannopoulos, the right winger speaking on campus.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was at this event. I actually engaged with several right wing folks and just kind of had long conversations. I really wanted to understand where they were coming from. And I do believe that discussion is a really, really good strategy under certain circumstances. And I was in a situation to be able to use that strategy, so I did. And so, I was there, I was observing. I can't really talk about a lot of it for a lot of reasons. Like, I'm still, like, things are still a little bit blurry for me. And there's still the case going on, and et cetera, but I'll kind of be kind of briefly talk about it. I saw somebody pepper spraying people in the crowd. They were unarmed. They were not confrontational. They were standing with their arms down, and he was pepper spraying directly into people's eyes. I, you know, stopped this person. There's the video, you know, that we've seen, and told them to give me the pepper spray and I'll let him go. And pretty shortly thereafter, something happened and I was shot.
How are you physically today?
Physically, I'm mostly all right. There's I occasionally find like weird bits of plastic underneath my skin, and you know I've got these sort of like this huge scar right through my favorite tattoo, which really irritates me.
It's a bummer.
It's a really beautiful tattoo. It took a year to get to put this together, and a year under the needle and then somebody shot it and, you know, put a big hole in it.
And you were telling me emotionally this is tough. It's tough to get shot.
Yeah, and it's not something that I've ever experienced, right? I kind of like have been learning the ins and outs of PTSD. My dad was in Vietnam, so I kind of like, I had seen it secondhand. I remember, you know, growing up and, you know, a car would backfire and he'd hit the ground. And I'd be like, what? And so like, you know, I've seen that, but you know, I remember like around the 4th of July, like fireworks going off and everything. And it was really intense and it was not like, it was really hard for me to be okay. And then, you know, later on I went to the gun range and shot and I was fine. So, you know,
okay.
Yeah.
So now let's turn to this video again, in case you've just tuned in. A lot of people have seen this man with the swastika armband knocked out cold on a Seattle sidewalk. And what did you think when you saw that?
I think my favorite version of the video right now is the one with the Seinfeld play at the end. I mean, so I feel a lot of different things, right? My immediate reaction was relief.
Relief?
Yeah.
Why?
So I had seen the picture of the guy with the swastika armband on the bus earlier.
Yeah, people were live tweeting yeah. as he was being spotted in Seattle. Hey, there's a guy with a swastika. He's on this bus. He's on this corner.
Yeah, so we knew that, you know, a group of people had known that he was going apparently downtown. And, you know, my immediate thought of, like, you know, seeing this guy with the swastika armband on the bus immediately reminded me of Portland and the Max.
You know, this is the incident on the train.
Yeah, where some of, you know, our friends were stabbed. You know,
yes.
Other anti-fascists were stabbed, were murdered while confronting a white nationalist. So the context is, you know, mass white supremacist terrorism, right? Mass violence. You know, you're saying like it was just words, right? Well, let's really actually stop and think about what, you know, those words, but more importantly, that symbol specifically.
Right, the swastika.
Yeah, this is not like let's have this kind of like edgy conversation about, you know, what's okay to say, and you know, that's not what the swastika, you know, that specific swastika and that specific configuration, that specific circumstance. So that's not what that meant. What that symbol means is lampshades made of human skin. It's jewelry made of human teeth. It's the industrial extermination of an entire group of people, of my family, of my friends, of people like me. That symbol, those words, that ideology is violence. So it's not like there was just sort of like, you know, this nonviolent person talking and they had a disagreement about an idea or a set of ideas. Nazism is ditches the size of swimming pools filled with human bodies.
So you're saying, in a sense, the puncher was intervening to defend someone.
That person was doing the thing that we, you know, that a lot of people celebrate police for doing. He was putting his life on the line in order to stop somebody from committing acts of violence, right? Like when I saw that person on the bus, you know, I immediately drew the connection between the terror attacks on the terror attack on the Max, other white supremacist terrorists. You know, there's another incident that we've seen a pattern of white supremacists drawing people into violence or like assaulting people. One of the scenarios I think of is there was an attack by a white supremacist who went to a Black Lives Matter rally, yelled racist things until people started coming towards him, drew these people into an alley and shot them, shot five people, and then pled self-defense.
We all know those connections are valid. And as you know, we're talking about in that moment, those victims that you described, they're not there. That crime, the legal crime, is not happening. That's vigilantism. Are you advocating that?
Can you clarify? I mean, like, the pattern of racist violence is there, right? So he's saying, with that symbolism, he's saying, I identify with the most dangerous terrorist group in the United States. I identify, and I am...
We don't know how he identifies with them. We don't, right?
I mean, like, if he had said, like, hey, I'm with ISIS, I'm here to you know, kill you, right? Like, he wouldn't have been met with a punch. He would have been met with a SWAT team.
Right, but he didn't... Well, we don't know whether he threatened physical violence.
Well, I mean, he actually did... I mean, so from other reports, he did threaten physical violence and also did, you know, assault people. But...
So let's say someone has seen this Seattle video or the violence in Berkeley and has concluded that your group, Antifa, that we talked to, that you're part of a violent group. I saw the violence in this video. I'm justified in punching you if you identify with Antifa.
Yeah, that's a complete failure to understand the context around which this has been happening, right? So we have 400 years of white supremacist violence, specifically in the case of this person, identifying with the most horrible people in the history of the planet, right? Like, people who are universally identified as, like, you use this word to describe the worst thing you possibly can.
Yeah.
Right? And he's saying, yeah, that's great. I want to do that. Right? And Antifa, like, anti-fascists have been opposing that since, like, the 40s. And abolitionists have been doing it before that. Right? And so, like, that's the context of history that we're in, right? People wanting to exterminate my people, you know, my friends, my family, and people trying to stop that.
Here's a take from, as you know, 3 weeks ago in Berkeley, some Antifa types were beating up an apparent right-wing demonstrator. You've seen that, hitting, kicking him on the ground. A public radio host named Al Letson protected the man being beaten, got on top of him, and yelled stop. Letson is African-American, certainly familiar with neo-Nazi and white supremacist violence and not a right-wing sympathizer. But he told me that all that, the politics, the violence in the past was irrelevant in that moment.
I don't want to give anybody any answers about what they should or shouldn't do. All I can say is that for me, in that moment, it didn't matter whether the guy on the ground was a white supremacist and he doesn't see my humanity. Like, my humanity isn't dependent upon him seeing mine. My humanity is dependent upon me seeing his. And so in looking at him in that place, you know, it felt like I didn't have a choice.
It doesn't matter if the neo-Nazi sees your humanity. What matters is that you see his. Where do you disagree with that?
Oh, I don't. There's a lot of subtlety that's lost in these sort of like soundbite kind of like conversations, right? So I can simultaneously...
That's why we're having a long conversation about this.
Right. So I can simultaneously say it is acceptable to use violence to defend oneself, to stop violence, et cetera, right? I can say that at the same time as I say that, you know, one of the best strategic approaches that I know about is... compassion, right? Like, and so having conversations and being compassionate and like this is a really great example of a good thing to do. And that's one strategy. And when it is possible to do that, it's great. But it's not always possible, right? I didn't see an opening for this. And I don't know the whole situation, right? Like, I don't see any situation where a strategy of compassion maybe could have worked here. Maybe it could have. I don't know. But I'm not going to condemn people who respond, right? So like I was saying, right, my immediate reaction was, you know, fear to see this person on the bus, you know, openly identifying as somebody who wants to exterminate me and people like me. You know, that's terrifying. It should be terrifying to you, too, because you are also a target, right? And everyone listening to this radio station right now, you know, pretty much everybody is on the list for extermination.
So would you have wanted that swastika-wearing man dead by the same connection you're making to Nazi crimes?
What I would want is a long conversation where we can talk about, you know, how did he get there? What was the thought process? What were the things that he went through? Can we, like, really get down to the deep insecurities that lead to Nazism, right? Because it's like it is a mental disorder, right? You know, the fact that the police, you know, kind of showed up and just checked on him and to see whether he was okay, like, that's a little bit problematic because there's really two scenarios here, right? The guy was there to kill somebody, right? We've seen the pattern of start violence and then draw a gun and shoot somebody, right? So he was there to kill somebody.
Maybe.
I mean, like, that's one of the reasonable scenarios, right? Another scenario is that he was there, you know, to get himself killed.
Or that he's mentally ill.
Mentally ill, right? And so, like, there are lots of situations. All of these situations, you know, the logical response is to say, hey, we need to put you under, like, you know, 72-hour watch. We need to understand what's going on here. You know, that's a compassionate response. It's like, you don't go home because you're not okay. You came to the place to get killed that way, right? Like, the fact that he survived is kind of amazing. And the compassionate response is like, hey, we need to make sure that you're okay and we need to talk through this. So I don't want to see anybody dead. When people have to use violence, I'm not going to condemn that. So that's the sort of like the subtlety around that. And not everybody has the emotional capacity to act with compassion. Not everybody has the emotional capacity because, like, things are really exhausting and, like, a constant attack of, you know, of white supremacists, right? Like, constantly attacking, constantly provoking, right? Like, that can wear people down.
Even if it's understandable, do you think that Antifa, and this, again, the puncher was not Antifa affiliated that we know of. We don't know. But do you
everybody's
think
everybody's Antifa?
Everybody's anti-fascist violence. What about President Trump getting to say there was violence on many sides? What about people seeing that video and not thinking about it the way you wish people would think about that punch?
I don't know that that's necessarily relevant. I don't get to determine the tactics of everybody, right? And especially, like, I don't get to do that, especially because, like, I'm not the first person who would be killed, right? And if there's somebody immediately facing, you know, immediately facing violence, right? Like, they probably have a better right to determine the right strategy in that situation than I do.
A lot of Trump opponents worry that America is coming apart. Are you, in a sense, in favor of more division in terms of more clarifying the lines?
No.
Are you okay? Okay. How do you feel about this moment we're in? Some people are worried for our country.
I think we should be worried, and we should have been worried for a really long time. The issues that we're facing right now are really unresolved issues from the Civil War and even before, right? The idea of whether a human being is a human being, right? That's what we're talking about. It's not just about you know, black folks being shot in the street, right? Or being put in cages, or, you know, or other people of color being attacked by the police, right? It's about the whole system of white supremacist violence.
But do you think that punch changed anyone's mind along those lines?
So there's another question, right? It's like there's a couple different strategies here, right? One is compassion. One is, like, bringing people. Another one is that, like, fascism is about people feeling safe. Fascists want to feel protected and safe. That's why they're fascists. They value safety over freedom, right? And so when you make it clear that fascism can't keep you safe, you do undermine the ideology, right? And I think that there are other ways to do that. And there are maybe better ways to do that, but I'm speaking from my privilege, you know? But that is a completely valid way to do that. Did it change anybody's mind? I don't know. So there's a really, there's kind of an interesting division that we're seeing, you know, open up, right? We've seen people kind of like ride the line between whether, you know, using, you know, questionably legal or illegal tactics is acceptable or not. You know, now we're seeing more and more the division where we start, you know, where liberals are starting to identify that, like, you know, symbols like the swastika are violence, right? We're seeing centrists sort of open up the divide between those who do believe that it is acceptable to use violence if necessary to defeat Nazis and those who've never heard of World War II. You know, we're seeing that widen, right? What I want is for us to like dig down and have deeper conversations. The big thing about like anti-fascism isn't about punching Nazis. That's the thing that happens every rare once in a while. And you do everything that you possibly can to avoid it, right? Violence is the last, absolute last resort. It's the tool of the Nazis, right? It's the thing that they use like first and as often as possible. And it's the thing that we use the absolute least and we avoid whenever we possibly can. So when we see violence in the street, when we see anti-fascists punching Nazis, right? It's because we haven't been able to figure out any other way to do that, right? We haven't been able to figure out any other way to change things. And we want to see things change.
Josh, we got to pause it there. Will you come back and talk about this as we're all watching this together and in other contexts besides a punch on Third and Pine?
Yeah, absolutely.
Josh Dukes, thanks for coming in. I'm glad you're physically recuperating, and I wish the same for your state of mind after what happened in Red Square. Thank you.
Excellent. Thanks.
We are, of course, discussing all of this on our Facebook page right now. I'll just choose a few of the many comments for you. Emily writes on this topic that swastikas are symbols of genocide, ethnic cleansing, and the ideology of white supremacy. If you are dumb enough to believe those things and flaunt that in public, you deserve to get punched. Sorry, not sorry, says Emily. Adrian says, unfortunately, this was what the guy wanted, a pic or video of liberals attacking him. Way to give him that. Tammy says, ignore him. Generally, these haters are looking for attention or a fight. Why give them what they want? They are white trash, says Tammy. Treat them the same way you would a cigarette butt someone has thrown on the ground. Shake your head in disgust and keep walking. Tom writes, can't celebrate violence, but at the moment, I also gotta love anything that shuts these scumbags up. Genevieve says, well, I would walk away, but glad that guy hit him. We are not going back to that era ever again. And finally, Nikki writes, I just can't be down with unprovoked violence. It's a slippery slope that I feel leads to more closed-mindedness for those who are disgusted and a recruitment tool for the undesirables. We'd love to know what you think of the conversation I just had with Josh Dukes and the conversation you just heard on Facebook. What is your take? What is your story? How do you know what you know? Send us an email, record@kuow.org, record@kuow.org. You can leave us a voicemail, 206-221-3663. Again, 221-3663. Do you have a story to tell? Are you thinking about all of this any differently today? 221-3663. KUOW 94.9 Seattle, back in a moment. This is KUOW. I'm Bill Radke.
It was frankly sad. You can say, well, but they are communists. Okay, they're communists. They are the worst Vietnamese in the entire world. We were the good Vietnamese. But let's face it, Vietnamese killing Vietnamese. How do you deny that? If you don't call that fratricide, what do you call that?
That's Phan Quang Thuy, who worked for the South Vietnamese government during the Vietnam War. It's from the new Ken Burns documentary on PBS, an 18-hour re-examination of the Vietnam War. That war, of course, has been over for more than 40 years, but the pain is fresh for some of the soldiers who fought it and for the children of refugees who fled their country for the United States. And we're going to talk now with two Seattleites about how that experience, their parents' experience, theirs, those cultural images still matter today and what we could do better. Tan Tan is a writer and storyteller for Microsoft and the host of a new KUOW podcast called Second Wave about the Vietnamese-American story. And James Hong runs the Vietnamese Friendship Association in Columbia City. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Tan, you grew up seeing impressions of the Vietnam War from TV and movies and from your parents who were refugees. How, it's a simplistic question, but how did that affect you, would you say?
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Where to begin? So I think I have always grown up with my feet in two worlds. So going to school, you're in a very white world influenced by pop culture.
In Olympia?
In Olympia, Washington. And then when you go home, my family spoke Vietnamese in the home. My mother was very busy, I think, you know, trying to be a good wife and a good mother and move on, like, from the war. She loved gardening. She worked for the state of Washington. My dad was also a civil servant. He rebuilt his life here as well. But he also took us to a lot of protests and to hunger strikes, asked us to help him proofread letters to Congress, you know, talking about human rights abuses in Vietnam. So my parents kind of had split perspectives. My mom was kind of ready to move on. My dad very much sort of left his heart, you know, in Vietnam and always felt this responsibility to not forget, you know, what was going on there and the circumstances that he left behind. So I think so I got a lot of different viewpoints, you know, in my head. And it wasn't always easy to try to reconcile all of these perspectives.
Yes. And you, of course, get into this at length in the podcast. But can you give us a sense of how you processed all that growing up?
Well, we process by not processing it, by not talking about our stories. I didn't know any better. I was just really young and naive. I was born here in the United States. Whatever happened during the war, I always felt like that is my parents' story and that happened before me. And now we're safe and we're here. So we just didn't talk about it. And my parents, you know, I always think like there were so many barriers. We have this language barrier because my parents' first language is Vietnamese. I speak primarily English. I do speak Vietnamese still, but that inhibits, you know, the type of conversations that you can truly have. Then we have the cultural barriers. My parents were very much very Vietnamese, where I was very Americanized. Then you have the intergenerational differences, where my parents really wanted to put that, they wanted to move beyond it. When refugees come here to America, the United States government expects you to pull yourself up and to move on, and you need to support yourself. And my parents went along with that. You know, they really did. And I think they wanted us to be able to take advantage of all the opportunities that they did not have. And so we didn't process it and we didn't talk about it. So now I'm, you know, in my 30s and realizing about the same age as my father when he came here to the United States and thinking about these questions. Do I have what it takes to cross an ocean to find better opportunities? And I actually don't think I have that courage and that will. So it's just made me more curious and it's made me more determined to talk to my parents and to ask these questions, not just of them, but of our other elders in our community as well.
I do want to talk about moving on, moving beyond, as you say, versus stopping and noticing as well and learning. And we also have James Hong here, who runs the Vietnamese Friendship Association in Columbia City. Did I understand it right that you were, in a sense, ashamed of being Vietnamese American at one point? Is that right?
Yeah, I'd say
why?
For the majority of my young life, it was a big burden to carry to know that you're the child of Vietnamese refugees, and having that culture clash between what my parents brought in terms of the heritage and the history versus what I was exposed to and surrounded by here growing up in America. Like Tan, I was, you know, born here in California.
California. I ask about ashamed because I think to a lot of people, the idea that your parents came with so little and that you and they overcame so much is a matter of pride.
It certainly is now, but at the time when I was a child, it felt like I had to choose between being a Vietnamese refugee culturally or being an American and everything that came along with that. I think it was, you know, a part of me being so young that I didn't really understand the implications of what that meant for my own identity and what it meant in terms of how we preserve that culture and that heritage.
And how do you think that might have compared to someone who is the child of a refugee from a different Asian country? What was there something unique about our cultural impression of what Vietnam means to America?
I certainly think so, because it's this strange duality. On the one hand, the story of, you know, refugees here in America, whether it's from Vietnam or other countries, are unique in the sense that, you know, many of us didn't choose to be refugees. It's a life that we weren't really given a choice about, versus this more traditional view of what it means to be American, to be born here and to be grew up here, and the types of privileges and that you inherit as a result of that.
I think specifically, too, like being a child of Vietnamese refugees, like think about what Vietnam means, you know, what that word conveys, the feelings that it conveys in American society and American culture. So for us specifically growing up, you know, it's like you've got Rambo, Apocalypse Now, all these movies about how damaging that war was to our veterans, you know, and to our soldiers. And then you have references to Vietnamese women. Most of the time, they're sexual references. And, you know, and you hear that and...
Like come-ons to GIs type of image?
Yeah, come-ons to GIs. I mean, I was watching a Modern Family marathon recently, like while I was cleaning up, and there were so many references to the father being a Vietnam vet and knowing how to perform certain sexual acts because of that time. You know, so it's kind of, that is like what we take in. And there wasn't a lot of representation in the media. So it was very limited. So, you know, the embarrassment comes from, you know, not only it's like, okay, my house smells like fish sauce because my mom cooks Vietnamese food at home, and I don't want to smell like that when I go to school, you know, and then you have these like movie references and pop culture references. And so that informs what your friends and other people outside of the home are thinking about you and who you are. And I think it makes like the Vietnamese community maybe in a way a little different, because Vietnam has been portrayed, you know, in pop culture a little more, I think, than like some other refugee groups.
Yeah. Well, then let's talk about, as you said, moving on, moving beyond, because I think, despite Ken Burns' new series, I don't think most young Americans are dwelling on the Vietnam War. You'd know better than I, but I wonder about, I mean, could you move beyond it even if you wanted to? Because I feel like a whole lot of Americans have, as far as I know, these are dated references we're making.
I think a couple things. Like, number one, we don't really learn about the Vietnam War in the first place. When I was in high school in the late 1990s, I don't remember how much time we spent on it, but it was a feeling that we're not spending as much time as we have on World War II, on the Civil War, you know? So, and I think that's because, you know, Ken Burns in the podcast that just came out today, the Second Wave podcast, talks about how we've just...
This is your podcast, yes. On KOW. You interviewed him.
Yeah, and he said, he's like, we have just oversimplified, you know, that war. And it's something Americans don't want to talk about and don't want to reflect on because we lost that war. It's the first and only conflict that America has just outright just didn't win and had to pull out in shame. And so that's kind of affected, you know, how we reflect on that conflict itself. And I think you need time too. I think 40 years is about enough time for a lot of the people who lived through that war to be removed from it and to be able to reflect on it. Because one of the reasons my family, and I'm sure maybe James can relate to this as well, one of the reasons our families did not talk about the war is because I think it was too painful for them. Why would you want to relive, you know, talking about surviving bombs and experiencing seeing, in my mother's case, your cousin get murdered in cold blood and having family members who fought on all sides of the conflict, and that created trust issues. You know, I mean, there's just a lot of painful stuff to unpack. And I think it's and I think we as Americans have a hard time confronting really painful history.
Yeah. So maybe now is the time.
Yeah, I definitely agree. You know, I tried the whole let's move beyond, let's forget about it and just take another step forward. And it didn't really work out for me, as I just shared before, kind of carrying that guilt and that burden. Mm-hmm. I think what's important now is to better understand the complexity of it and all the different perspectives and experiences as it relates to the Vietnam War and everything that followed it. Not in a way to diminish those types of stories and experiences, but as a way to better reflect on it and use it to empower us and increase our understanding of how we can actually move forward together as a community and as a country in regards to new things that are happening with refugees now, whether they're from Syria or from other countries.
Yeah.
You know, the refugee story, it's not over. It's still going on. It's just changing where it comes from.
It's still going on. And I think James and I, we're friends. And like, we've talked about this, where it's like, Vietnamese refugees, we have a voice here. We can be speaking up for the refugees who are trying to flee the Middle East. And why are we not doing that? And I think a part of that is because we haven't owned our own story and we haven't acknowledged our own story. And the history about the Vietnam War has been dominated by Western perspectives, non-Vietnamese voices. And so, you know, we are trying, in a way, we have to make up for lost time. And, you know, we are the next generation. We speak English. We were educated here. So we're privileged enough to be able to hopefully have a voice, build up and understand, like, what is our story? What is our history? And make sense of it. Yeah.
Are you, I take it you're watching every moment of the Ken Burns documentary. How are you taking it in? Privately viewing parties.
I watched all 18 hours before I interviewed Ken Burns and Lynn Novick for the documentary. That was like a requirement. So yeah. I've seen the whole thing, and it is. I describe it as being a visceral experience. And as I was taking notes, watching every episode, there were a lot of F bombs. Just typing like F, you know, like yeah. because I felt like I was seeing Vietnamese families. For the first time, I felt, God, I'm seeing my family. I'm seeing what my mother, my father, my grandmother, my grandfather, you know, like I'm seeing what they lived through and I'm seeing what they survived, because it is horrific. Because you see those violent scenes like throughout the countryside and the result of, you know, people getting shot and bombed, and it's traumatic, you know, but it felt like, I don't know, but I think I've always felt really removed from the Vietnam War. But watching it, it was just like, it was an intense experience. And it made me appreciate, you know, the fact that I have the life that I have.
Yeah, I'd say I'm on the other end of the spectrum as Tan. I've gone through the trailer, and I look forward to, like, seeing all the other episodes. I'm especially excited in talking to my parents about it and my friends to kind of get their reactions as well. Mainly in a way to help me process mm-hmm. what I'm seeing and what I'm learning.
But Tan, did you ever think, yeah, this is 18 hours of a white perspective on the Vietnam War?
You know, that was something I was really sensitive about. Like months ago, I've been tracking and following, you know, this film ever since I heard about it a few years ago when I moved back to Seattle. And yes, I was sensitive about that. And I think the Vietnamese community is also sensitive about that, because I have seen, you know, many forums and places where we talk about the war and Vietnamese perspectives are not included. But that is actually what makes this film quite extraordinary, in that you hear not just one Vietnamese perspective, but you hear many. So you hear the perspective of the South Vietnamese soldier. You hear the perspective of the North Vietnamese soldier, who's a communist. You hear the perspective of the Viet Cong. They were the communist infiltrators in the South. You know, and I found that to be really eye-opening, because it didn't fit with this narrative. You know, not everybody grew up in a political household like I did, but I really did grow up thinking that communists were evil, that this was a black and white thing, that this was a war about freedom. This is us versus them. They wanted to take away our freedom. And now I think about it, it's kind of ridiculous, you know, but when you watch the film and you see all of these different perspectives, you know, there's only so much that you can fit into 18 hours. It is still dominated by white perspectives, Western American perspectives, but I truly appreciate, I really think that Ken Burns and Lynn Novick really made an effort to go beyond the obvious and get beyond the black and white, and I appreciate that.
So, Tan, your podcast, Second Wave, do you assume that the listenership is mostly non-Vietnamese American, like KUOW's audience? And if so, what are you saying to those listeners?
Well, when we were creating the podcast, I think I felt a lot of this pressure, because I felt like, oh my God, it's like rep sweat. I have to represent the older
rep
Vietnamese.
Sweat.
Yeah, the older Vietnamese, the younger Vietnamese, like Vietnamese speaking, English speaking. And that's a really heavy burden. And, you know, the team, my editor, you know, Jim Gates, producer Caroline Chamberlain, we went through a lot of training and thinking about who is our audience. And I think we have to recognize that the podcast audience tends to be like highly educated, you know, okay in the income area, coastal elites. We have to recognize like that is the current audience. But I also felt the problem that we're trying to solve is that people like me felt that our stories were not represented, are not represented in the media. So somebody, that is the problem that we need to solve. And so we kind of ended up doing a lot of research and thinking about who do we think our audience is? And we kind of came up with a persona where we think we're trying to target Vietnamese Americans, young English speaking, who are very much like me and probably come from backgrounds like James and myself, where your parents don't really want to talk about it. There's a language barrier, there's a cultural barrier, but you're curious. And so hopefully the podcast sort of bridges that gap and helps, listeners to sort of gauge where they're at in understanding their own story and identity, and maybe helps to give them some tools to know how to talk to their parents and to their family members and how to navigate and talk about these very difficult subjects.
Tan Tan, host of KUOW's new podcast, Second Wave, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
James Hong, executive director of the Vietnamese Friendship Association in Seattle. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The new episode of Second Wave is an interview with Ken Burns, right? And Lynn Novick?
Yes.
About their 10-part series, The Vietnam War,
yeah.
Which Tan has seen all of, James has seen none of, and maybe we'll all come together and watch it together now. That's an interesting idea. You were saying that maybe now is the exact time. Find the podcast Second Wave at KUOW.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Great to talk to you both.
Thanks. Thank you.
We're on Twitter at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. We'll talk to you tomorrow.